everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to our podcast on restaurantguysradio.com or download them on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm just great.
Yeah, just great?
I don't sound great, do I?
You do not sound great. You sound less than great.
I'm actually great. There are a couple things we want to talk about in our first little segment today. It's been an interesting week or so in the restaurant news. I know that you have, but you heard about this waitress from the St. Louis area Applebee's?
Yes, yes. I did indeed see that.
A customer left a receipt, and it was a large party, and for large parties at Applebee's, they add a 20% gratuity. And they asked that the check be split.
18% gratuity.
18% gratuity. And they asked that just the check be split. And so the computer automatically adds 18% onto the parties of that size.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is Applebee's, okay, they're not making a lot of money to begin with.
Well, it's not just that. Realize that the reason that's added to large checks is because when you have a lot of places, you get a certain percentage of the covers of the number of people who walk in the door. So if you get a party of 10, they may be half of your income for the day.
Right.
So, you know, in the restaurant business, gratuities even out.
Yeah.
So if you have 10 parties of two, some of them will leave you a lot, some of them will leave you a little, and it'll even out. When you get large parties like that, your whole day is dependent upon whether or not that party tips you in an appropriate manner. And if they don't, if they stiff you, for instance, if they leave you zero, then you literally have lost half of your income for the day. And, you know, that's not a tenable situation for somebody who makes their money day to day.
Well, so what happened was they put this, they handed out the checks, and the waitress picks up the check, and one of them, the check says,
the gratuity's crossed out.
And the gratuity's crossed out.
As zero.
And it's not marked, it's just crossed out. And
then they add the total, and they've added the total without the gratuity.
And it says, I only give God 10%. Why do you get 18? And stiffed the waitress. And then she writes that she wrote that she was a pastor, and she only gives God 10%. I can't even believe. First of all, God's got plenty of money. Secondly, God's
works though take lots of money. Let's not disparage the money that people give to good works.
I in no way meant to do that.
Because Mr. Meanie Man.
No. What I'm saying is, you give God 10% of your income. Mm-hmm. You don't. It's not like a tax that you give God on what you buy for your burger at the Cheesecake Factory or at Applebee's, right? And God doesn't work for $2 an hour. I mean, what are you talking about? So I don't have to pay my workers because I pay God? What are you talking about?
That's the craziest thing I ever heard.
If you want
not to mention, how's that waitress going to give God her 10%? You didn't give her anything.
Right. And how's she going to feed her kids? Or mm-hmm. how's she going to pay her bill? Crazy stuff, right? So in any event, the waitress's friend, the other waitress we'll call her, takes a quick
photo
of the receipt, not putting in that it's Applebee's, mm-hmm. not meaning really to put in the person's name, and post it online on her Facebook page as a joke, right? Like, can you believe?
Because it is a joke.
What a dickhead somebody is, right? In the name, and hides behind Christianity, and while doing a very unchristian thing,
while being completely not Christian.
So, someone recognizes the signature of Alois Bell. Her name, everyone, is Alois Bell. So Alois Bell's signature, and her friend alerts her that this is up on the web. And she calls the restaurant, this Christian pastor woman, lest you think it was a momentary lapse in judgment, which she is now claiming. She calls the restaurant, demands to have the manager fired, demands to have the waitress fired.
Demands to have the entire service staff
everyone who was involved fired. Fired.
Demands to have the entire service staff of the restaurant fired.
Because that's what Jesus would do. And I think
you're going to have to take the fish off the back of your car, ma'am.
Yeah. So she demands the whole service staff be fired, and the waitress does indeed get fired, the one who posted it. Mm. Now, I And so when this went out in the internet, now everyone wants to know who Alois Bell is, and so all of our internet sleuths are out there like, it's Alois Bell, this is her picture, this is her church, and this is where she's a pastor. And so now Alois Bell is like, oh, it was a momentary lapse in judgment. I left $6 on the table in cash. Because that makes a lot of sense that you crossed that out and you wrote that because you left $6 on the table in cash. And you're just a bitch.
You caught me by surprise. I got to tell you, I knew you were going to say something not nice.
And right,
not
and right now, Pastor Bell, you're a lying bitch. And you're an un-Christian woman is what you are. And so anyway, did she call the restaurant and say, oh, my God, please hire that waitress back? Mm. Please hire that working person back and give them their job back? No, she didn't. Did she go and offer to hire that woman at her church and give her a job? No, I don't think she did that. You know why? Because she doesn't mean it.
Because there were negative ramifications for her, what she thought she could do underhandedly,
right,
under the radar,
right,
this nasty little thing she thought she was going to do. And then she compounded it when she called and complained to the restaurant.
Yeah.
Okay, because she didn't call to complain to the restaurant and say, hey, your waitress needs to take that down off her
right,
website because I don't like what it says about me, even though
it's
just a snapshot of what actually happened. She called and demanded that all of the service staff of the restaurant be fired.
And then when 100,000 people from Facebook were like, this lady's a bitch and un-Christian, then she's like, oh, I'm sorry. It was a momentary lapse in judgment. I'm not really like that. You know what? You are really like that.
That's okay? What you're really like.
That's what you're really
exactly.
like. Now, I think that this leads to another, there's a wrinkle here. And I was talking to some folks about this. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, can you believe they fired her? You know what? I can. And you know what? They probably should have. And I'm sorry to say that. And look, I think somebody else should hire her right away. But Applebee's, you can't have an employee. And it wasn't meant
100%.
To do. But you can't have an employee disclose a customer's dining transaction. It's, you know, that's confidential stuff.
No, like, no matter how terrible the customer was.
And
okay, you know what? Last week I told a story of some folks who came into the restaurant and their behavior. But I didn't divulge to any of you who the customers were.
Now, I think if someone assaults you, if someone steals from you, then maybe that you as a company might choose as a company to divulge that person's name. You know, it's maybe, but you can't have your staff decide to publish at any point the financial transactions of your customers.
Mm.
And I believe that she probably left the signature on there by mistake. You know, I don't think she meant to identify that customer, but by the same token, your diners have to be sure that, like, look, I don't want people to know I ordered an expensive bottle of wine. I don't want people to know that I ordered an inexpensive bottle of wine. I don't want someone.
I don't want
to
people
know
to know that we shared a chicken.
I don't want people to know that I was there last night. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't really do that. So, I think that, you know, I would hire this woman. I would if this woman would like a job. I don't have the waitress's name here, do I? No, I don't. Welch is her last name. Chelsea Welch. Chelsea Welch would like to apply for a job at Stage Left because of Lombardi. Go to stageleft.com/employment and we'll give you a fair consideration. But I do understand why Applebee's had to let you go. But the pastor's a bitch. And you know what I think would be beautiful? If her congregation relieved her of her duties.
I think that would be appropriate.
Way more appropriate than that waitress losing her job. Way more
like I said, I didn't think it was great, obviously, of her to cross out the tip and write the things that she wrote. But to call up and you know, but who knows what happened at the table? Okay, we don't know what happened at the table that night. Maybe there was some interaction.
But you know what?
To call up and demand that she and all of her coworkers be fired, it is not pastoral.
And you know what? I'm going to call you out on that.
I would say that's an inappropriate use of the word pastoral.
I'm going to call you out on the we don't know what happened at the table, because I don't think anything happened on the table, and I'll tell you why. If she hadn't written, I only give God 10%, then you'd say, maybe, who knows? Maybe the waitress was a bitch. Maybe service was bad. Maybe she dropped her food. But I only give God 10% means I don't tip waitresses. I don't tip waitresses. That's what that means. Because I'm Christian, so I don't have to tip waitresses, which is just the freaking opposite. And I think it'd be sweet to see Alois Bell fired. I think that'd be kind of cool. Although I'm not going to call and demand it because I'm a little more Christian than that. Hey, stick with us. We're going to talk with Josh Czerski about his new book, Colonel Sanders and the American Dream, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is Josh Czerski. His books include Meet Me in Manhattan, The Hamburger, A History. He is the food columnist for Time Magazine, and his new book is Colonel Sanders and the American Dream.
Hey, Josh, welcome back to the show.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Not a lot. We have a lot to talk about. It's been a long time since you've been on The Restaurant Guys. Welcome back.
Well, it's good to be back.
Now, Colonel Sanders would not be normally the fodder for most restaurant guys. That wouldn't be the type of fodder, restaurant fodder for the restaurant guys, but this is a pretty darned interesting book. And one of the things that I think a lot of folks don't realize who are maybe younger than the three of us on this radio program right now is that Colonel Sanders, unlike Aunt Jemima and other, icons, was a real guy.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was. In fact, that was sort of the problem. If he was too real, they would have liked him better if he was, you know, like Uncle Ben or somebody, a pliable corporate entity, you know, whose behavior and comments they could control, but they never could. You know, he would go around complaining about, you know, chicken was shitty. He famously did an interview with Mimi Sheraton in the New York Times there, where they went to a local KFC and he told her that the gravy was like wallpaper paste and everything.
Well, and that was after he sold at some point. When did he finally sell?
It started out with him selling it. I mean, when he owned it, there really wasn't a KFC, you know, per se. It was basically like you would go to a diner somewhere and they would have on the menu, it would say Colonel Sanders original Kentucky Fried Chicken. But, I mean, he basically just licensed the recipe, the name, and the spice mix. It was only when he sold it, which happened very soon after he started the business, that there was actually the red and white, you know, restaurant with the bucket and the sign. And, you know, that really wasn't his doing so much as there's a guy named Pete Harmon that was his greatest franchisee that, for all intents and purposes, invented KFC as we know it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I like about your book, and, you know, we talk about all sorts of things related to food on this show, and it's, of course, Mark and my excuse to call up anybody we want to who's written something interesting and get them on the show to chat. This book is really about the guy more than it is about the chicken. Is that fair?
Well, it is fair, but, I mean, what makes him, you know, I mean, he happened to have an especially interesting life, but you know, my thing is always that I was actually trained as a historian, and I am always interested in how people's stories sort of exemplify or provide a kind of, you know, a microcosmic view of things that matter, things that happen, you know, stories that are essential to understanding, you know, American life and American culture. So, like, the fact that he did chicken matters. Like it wouldn't be the same story if he was like Glenn Bell or somebody who's the Taco Bell guy. Like, you know, the fact that fried chicken has such a deep and dark, in many ways, kind of a, you know, resonance and a history behind it, you know, as sort of this kind of like iconic food for, you know, African Americans in the South. I mean, it's weird, you know, that the most famous fried chicken cook would be a white man in a planter's suit, you know?
Yeah, a person who would never cook chicken.
Yeah.
Right.
Although he did.
I mean, in his case, he did.
Right.
I mean, that was like, he was sort of in planter drag anyway. I mean, he was basically like, you know, a poor white who later in life, you know, came up with this whole shtick. But, you know, that's the dirty secret of the Sanders family.
Well, I mean, I read this story, or a lot of it anyway, as a story about American entrepreneurship as well. That was kind of what I took from it was, you know, that you try one thing and it doesn't work. If you're a true entrepreneur, you try one thing, it doesn't work. You try the next thing, it doesn't work. You try the next thing, it doesn't work. You try the next thing, it works, and then you lose it. You try the next thing, and it works, and you lose it. And then something finally sticks and becomes what you're known for.
Right, middle-aged failures can take great consolation in Colonel Sanders' story because he had washed out. I mean, he had washed out at everything, and then he finally got, you know, he finally had a product that was successful and he finally had some success in his life and was making some money. You know, after like 50 years of trying, he had that Sanders Cafe, you know, and it was in a, he had a hotel and, you know, people loved it. It was a big road food standard, the original Duncan Hines, who was like the first great, you know, road food guy, had written about it in his guidebook. And then that went out of business.
Yeah, so, the story you tell in the book about how he had this great restaurant, and the franchises and all was that was a, or you know, selling the secret spices was a sideline, and they literally rerouted the highway around his.
Well, that happened to a lot of places in America.
What a heartbreak!
Yeah, I mean, but I mean that just goes to show you. I mean, like he came from a background where, I mean, if you were alive, you were basically ahead of. You know.
Well, talk to us about where Colonel Sanders came from before he was Colonel Sanders. I mean, he spends, you know, basically three centuries, his presence anyway, spans three centuries, and his influence spans three centuries. And tell us about, I mean, it was really compelling reading in your book where this guy came from and what the conditions that he arose out of and how he got out of them. Can you share with us a little bit of that?
Like, yeah, I mean, like, the thing you have to understand about somebody like Colonel Sanders coming as he did from the... you know, the southern part of Indiana and the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries, is that life wasn't that different for him than it might have been for a medieval peasant farmer.
Right.
You know, or a Russian serf or something. I mean, basically, he had the means of getting sustenance, but little else. He had a single mom, and she worked in a canning factory and barely, you know, made enough to live off that. So from the time that he was 7 years old, he was caring for his siblings and, you know, working in fields. I mean, it was like patches or something. I mean, it was just a really brutal upbringing. And his subsequent career basically, you know, it spanned every kind of bad make work job you can possibly think of. I mean, he was a mule tender for the army. I mean, he was a tire salesman. He was a quack obstetrician, you know. I mean, a lot of the things that he said in his autobiography, which is really the only way that most of us know anything about his life, I'm sure he embellished or exaggerated. But I mean, there's pictures of him in his Michelin suit when he was a tire salesman, dressed up as the Michelin man. I mean, he was floating freely in the American life of the 20th century, and everything that happened in that period could, you know, either did or could have impacted his life in one way or another.
But he was a larger than life fellow, from what you say, and he seemed to have many great successes that all then crashed and burned. It wasn't like he, you know, barely held on for 40 years. I mean, the story was fascinating because I was really rooting for him by the end.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he was one of those guys that, you know, like, we've all seen them. I mean, they have great charisma. They have all this ideas. You know, they're incredibly creative, and they can get people caught up. And they're just great salesmen, but they just have no business sense at all.
Right.
I mean, in fact, that even extended to the sale of Kentucky Fried Chicken, which was one of the worst deals of all time. I mean, I guess it wasn't as bad as like the monster deal with Dr. Dre or something.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he basically made less money. He sold the whole company basically for the same amount of money that he was already making, and then lost all the rights to it forever. I mean, he was reduced essentially to being basically a brand spokesman, like Aunt Jemima, you know, or Uncle Ben or someone.
And and talk to us about some of the trouble he made for the company after he left. I mean, it was that was his problem with. Was he sour about the deal, or was it just that when he saw things weren't going to his standards, he didn't like that?
Well, like all, you know, small businessmen, and especially like all small restaurant owners, he was a control freak. And, you know, I mean, his chicken wasn't just the same chicken that everybody else made, you know, with a slightly different spice blend. I mean, he invented, for all practical purposes, the idea of pressure frying. And, you know, they had to adopt his techniques for this immense, gigantic mass market. You know, I mean, they had to do things to vast economies of scale, and really in a way that required absolutely no cooking ability. So basically, like any minimum wage teenager could do it. So there's no way that he would have ever been happy with the quality control level at Kentucky Fried Chicken, particularly in those decades after the, you know, the sale, when the business passed through a series of indifferent corporate overlords. And, you know, he felt rightly that it represented him. He was the guy whose face was on the bucket. And he wanted it to be done right. He wanted it to be good. He didn't want the you know, gravy to taste like wallpaper paste. He wanted it to be his gravy. He wanted the chicken to be his chicken. So he was very vocal, not just in public, but also in terms of speaking to the other franchisees. You know, there was like a great story where some franchisees, he really hated the quality of the spices that he was getting.
Okay.
At one time, you know, they were obviously, you know, they were stepping on it. They were stepping on the mix a lot. And then they were also buying the cheapest, shittiest spices they could possibly get away with.
Right.
Assuming rightly that no one would know the difference.
Right.
And so he found a guy who had this like little boutique spice business in Indiana, and he had the guy make up the spices just the way he wanted. And then he started selling those to the franchisees. And of course, eventually they got wind of it at KFC, and they sued him, and they told him that only their own proprietary spices could possibly be used by franchisees. Meanwhile, like, he sued them back. It was a big disaster. But the cool thing about it is that that spice company is still in business and sells his proprietary spice blend under the name 99X, because they can't call it original recipe.
That's great. But it can't be used in a Kentucky Fried Chicken now, right?
No.
Oh, we got to put we'll put the link up to 99X up on
yeah,
this show.
You can actually get it delivered on the internet, and you can make the Colonel's chicken.
Oh, I love that.
That's great. That's great.
The way he made it.
And Josh, I know the answer to this question before I ask it, but you've done this, right? Have you made the Colonel's chicken?
Oh, hell yeah! I use it as a condiment. I'll buy the chicken wings from the Chinese ghetto takeout restaurant, and I'll put it as a condiment on the chicken after it's, you know, after the styrofoam box is open.
So was,
I also use it for chicken fried steak. It's freaking great seasoning.
Was Kentucky Fried Chicken really awesome?
Well, no one knows now, because nobody, you know, who ate it when he was doing it is either alive or reliable enough to speak to the issue. I mean, I think the closest you could come is if you found out the exact methods that he used, the actual, you know, when he started doing it, he did it with the kind of kettle style pressure cooker that sits on your stovetop and has a little button that rattles when, you know, when things are ready.
And it sometimes explodes in your kitchen.
It sometimes explodes. I mean, if you got 99X and you got a good country chicken, the kind of old time chickens where like the breast is the size of a lady's fist, you probably have a pretty good bead on what it was like. But, you know, I'm sure he cooked it in lard or something like that. I mean, you got to figure, like, the way the Colonel did it was the way he, as a Southerner, was brought up. So it was undoubtedly, you know, a lot of animal fat involved. And probably the subsequent batches, you know, were even better, because then they had all the cooked chicken schmaltz. And
right, as you season, and that keeps going and going. It's not like Crisco.
So, he probably did use some kind of, like, shortening like that, too, you know. I mean, poor people love that kind of thing. I guarantee you something else, too. There's no way in hell that at one point or another the Colonel wasn't using a lot of MSG.
Oh, really? That was an additive back then?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly when it was developed, but they had it by the 50s. And to this day, MSG is like the secret weapon of all soul food cooks.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Like anywhere you go, whether it's in Harlem or the Deep South or whatever, if you're eating soul food, you're eating MSG.
You know, when we opened our
MSG got kind of a bad rap, though. I mean, it's a type of sodium,
yeah.
and it's some people are allergic to it. It gives some people headaches.
It's pure umami. Like if you go to these, you know, like some boutique, you know, restaurant, they'll tell you, you know, oh, our dashi broth provides a punch of umami. Like the dashi broth, all it is, you know, for people that can't afford, you know, MSG.
That's funny. You know, when we opened our second restaurant, we took over a space formerly occupied by a Chinese restaurant, and we found these huge tubs of MSG up there. We were like, we could pour this in the Raritan River and give all of Middlesex County a headache. It was a
three 100-pound barrels, and on their menu, it read all over the place, no MSG.
No MSG, yeah. That's
very, very amusing.
Well, you know, I tell you, it's very sad.
I think there may be a dump out in the where's Living? Is Livingston in Piscataway?
Livingston campus.
You know, I'm a graduate of Livingston College, by the way.
I did know that, and it no longer existed. We're graduates of Rutgers College, and it no longer exists. It's all one big university now.
Really?
Yes,
sir. Nobody told me that.
They combined all the colleges into one faculty for arts and sciences and one faculty for science faculty. Yeah. So.
Well, that's a sad development. I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sorry to interrupt, though. What were you saying, guys?
Now, I had a question. Why do you think that Sanders gave up his, you know, this franchise so easily? Why do you think he sold so easily?
Is it just he couldn't do it?
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember, like, he was over 70 years old, you know, when it first got sold. Like, the Colonel was born in 1890. He didn't sell it until, like, what, 1960. What was it? I'm blanking a little bit now, but it was definitely in the early 60s, maybe 62 or 63. So he was already 73 years old. I mean, he was an old man, a spent force for, you know, in a lot of ways as soon as it started to exist. So there was no way that he could do it effectively.
Well, I want to talk about one other thing before we get off the topic of Kentucky Fried Chicken and your wonderful book. What is a Kentucky? I know the answer to this, but what is a Kentucky Colonel? Can you share with our listeners what that is and how he used it to his advantage?
You know, the Kentucky Colonelcy is like one of those like sort of cheesy honorary titles, like getting the key to the city or something. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's like if somebody gets it, like, you know, I hereby proclaim Harlan Sanders the king, you know, the Mr. Fried Chicken. Like, that's about how meaningful
right,
it is.
Right, right.
Anybody who petitions the governor, I mean, can become a colonel. I guess, you know, typically, I guess somebody has to smear, you know, the governor's office in some way. But, you know, it's something that they give, like, I'm guarantee you Rick Pitino is a Kentucky colonel.
Basically,
just a piece of paper.
I learned about bourbon, well, shortly after we opened our first restaurant 20 years ago. I took a motorcycle ride down to visit Colonel Elmer T. Lee. And he's a Kentucky colonel. He was a master distiller at Ancient Age Distillery for a while. And I know that the colonelcy is just a name given you by the governor, but it made it better for me somehow, sitting with Colonel Lee.
Better than saying mister, for sure.
Yeah, I'm a northerner. I can't be a colonel, you know.
You could be a colonel. They could easily make you a colonel.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to, though, Josh. I don't know. Hey, listen, when we come back, I want to talk about one of your articles that you wrote, written in Time Magazine, where we talk about an interesting phenomenon called the dumbbelling of American cuisine. Will you stick with us over the break?
Sure, why not?
You should check out Josh Jezerski's new book. It's called Colonel Sanders and the American Dream. You can find out more about it at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, and our guest is Josh Jezerski. He is the food columnist for Time Magazine. His new book is Colonel Sanders and the American Dream. And I wanted to talk to you, Josh, about an article that you wrote recently in Time really caught my eye, and it's really a salient topic, and it's coming up a lot. You call it the dumbbelling of American cuisine.
And Josh, you know that it's a good article because it literally crossed Francis and my email boxes.
He
was sending
each
it to me,
yeah,
while I was sending, yeah, it to him.
No, that's cool.
So tell us, what is the dumbbelling of American cuisine?
Well, I have to say, first off, that I didn't invent the term dumbbelling.
Mm-hmm.
It was used The original context was that the legendary restaurant consultant Michael Whiteman used it to describe the way menus in a lot of fast food restaurants, you know, were basically losing their middle ground. Like there'd be the dollar menu and then there'd be, you know, like some kind of hideous Angus burger or something that cost $7.
Mm-hmm.
But it struck me that it was actually true in an even larger way of American dining as a whole, because, you know, the thing that people sort of take for granted about, you know, American food is that there's all these, you know, shitty restaurants and bad taste, like the Mama Leone's of the world, the Olive Gardens, the Ground Rounds, you know, and those kind of restaurants have really sort of taken a beating, and it seemed to me to be very, very representative of what was happening in the country economically, how, you know, there was this sort of gastrocrat class, you know, these one percenters that were going around to these, you know, tweezer restaurants and so on, and then there was, you know, all these kind of horrible fast food, you know, things, the processed pink slime variants, and then, you know, it was becoming more and more difficult for ordinary working Americans to go out and eat a decent meal. And I don't think that too many people have really remarked on that. I think that progressives focus on, you know, the fact that there's these, you know, food deserts or whatever, and the, you know, King Corn, you know, and the agribusiness, and they're right to criticize all those things. But the real impact, I think, for the lives of Americans is the disappearance of affordable dining, and especially the small independent restaurants that, you know, really made up in a lot of ways the social life of American small towns, you know. I mean, how many new family diners have opened up in your town lately, you know?
None.
Yeah, no.
Where's the Liberty Diner of tomorrow? Mm-hmm. Where's the Hansel and Gretel of tomorrow?
Mm-hmm. Wow, you know your new brother.
You know, it's funny that you say that, and I, you know, Francis and I last week we stumbled into Restaurant Week in New York City strictly by accident, and I wonder if that's maybe why Restaurant Week has become so popular, because there is no moderately priced, you know, really decent dinner out there, or very few of them. You know, that Restaurant Week has kind of taken hold with so many people, where they're like, you know, I have a chance to go out and have a good meal
for $35
and not break the bank.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the thing is, the thing that I find especially depressing about that is that there's a lot of restaurants that people only get to go to during Restaurant Week.
Yeah, definitely.
You know.
You know, it's funny, but the family diner you talk about in the article, you talk about, you know, the Friendlies, the Ground Round, that kind of place. That was sort of a working man's inexpensive way to go out and have dinner. I mean, we do have, like, the Cheesecake Factory and whatever other, there are some Italian chains, but they're a little higher end than you're talking about, right? They don't quite fill the niche.
No, I mean, like, look, there's still, the Cheesecake Factory is actually, like, a great success story because, I mean, you know, like, maybe the food is a little bit gross in certain ways, but
don't hold back, Josh. How do you really feel?
Well, I mean, look,
love that you just said that on my show.
You,
that was phenomenal.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the food is gross, but the portions are gigantic. You can take kids there.
That
the food is terrible, but luckily there's a lot of it.
That should be their new slogan.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, the problem with the Cheesecake Factory, you know, is that it's not that the food is bad or that, you know, it's too cheap or it's too expensive. The problem is that it's a giant corporation and it's the same everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it really comes down to a similar situation, the kind of controlled monopolies that you see, you know, like with the big cable utilities or with, you know, newspaper ownership, where three or four big companies control the whole section of the market. And so there's no innovation. There's, you know, there's no real impetus to try to come up with things that are better.
Josh, as a restaurant owner, and Francis and I were just discussing this exact thing the other day. There's a new restaurant supply place. Not that new, I guess it's been in existence for 10 or 15 years, called the Restaurant Depot, and we use it to buy trash bags and bleach and Pine Sol and products like that. But a lot of restaurants use this place as their food source. The inexpensive restaurants are using this place. So everybody's serving the same frozen mozzarella sticks.
Yeah.
And nobody's making mozzarella, breading it, and frying it themselves.
Or even buying mozzarella and breading it and buying it themselves.
Even a trip to the Restaurant Depot practically counts as you know, artisanal labor. It's easier just to have everything delivered from Sysco.
Yeah, it's a similar kind of thing. But, you know, we go out, and if you're in the restaurant business, you go to various restaurants and you think, Sysco fries, Restaurant Depot fries. And, you know, you recognize the food as the frozen prepackaged stuff. What was it? There was something that you can get stuff that's like pre-cooked.
Like totally done. I mean, just like a, you know, jalapeno poppers and people are like putting these things on their menu and they're basically dropping it in a deep fryer and putting it on their menu. And 1,000 other restaurants have exactly the same jalapeno. I don't understand why you want a restaurant to take somebody else's jalapeno poppers and drop them in a fryer and serve them to somebody. I don't understand that.
Well, I'll tell you why, because the restaurants that do that, for the most part, are not really owned by cooks or local people. They're basically, you know, they're essentially businesses, you know, owned by other businesses, which are in turn owned by other businesses, and are entirely exist as a profit making enterprise. So it doesn't make any sense to make your own mozzarella if you're looking. I mean, if you're a publicly traded company,
Go ahead. I just remember what, Mark, that you pointed out to me when you're looking through one of these catalogs for that we could buy wholesale. Pre-cooked, ready-to-heat gyro strips.
Ah, the gyro strips. Here, yeah.
They're stripped off the thing. That's horrible. But I think that I would rather have some of the restaurants that you talk about, the old Ground Round or the old Friendlies. I think that they were serving better food than the Cheesecake Factory is today, or that the Bonefish Grill is today.
Well, the Bonefish Grill is I think places like the Bonefish Grill, which I would also sort of put in the same category. I mean, those are restaurants that are like, they're not just serving sports bar food. You know, they're trying to like give somebody a fish, you know, and two vegetables at an affordable cost. I mean, the thing that grosses me out is these restaurants that, you know, I mean, and those really have suffered a lot too. The Bennigan's and Applebee's type restaurants, where literally everything on the menu is glorified snack foods.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, some of those restaurants like actually use fresh food. Like the Bonefish Grill actually uses, you know, fresh food. I mean, the meatloaf is actually made from hamburgers. So
yeah, I mean, I'll give them that, but it's not tasty.
Well, it's not tasty, you know. But I mean, there's a lot of local restaurants that are not that tasty either. And remember Greasy Tony's, you know?
I do, actually.
I think it just comes down to the fact that, you know, eating is something people have to do, and it should be part of society, you know, not on the vast economic grid, not on the, you know, the grid of, you know, macroeconomics. It should be something that, you know, people should have restaurants in the same way that people eat meals. It should be a business that people have and a, you know, like people go to chef school now entirely so that they can work for huge restaurants and then start huge restaurants of their own, or worse still, go on TV, you know. So I think that it's not just nostalgia. I think that it really hurts society if the only people that are feeding us are approaching the business, you know, the same way as like a software company would.
Mm. Again, I had a conversation with a customer at the bar last night because we were talking to our staff and you try and explain the business aspect of the restaurant business because it is indeed a business with someone. But there's something that a mom and pop has that a corporation doesn't have. And what a corporation has is profit motivation. And bottom line is the number one aspiration. When you go to a mom and pop, it's somebody's life.
Yeah.
It's somebody's reputation. It's somebody's self-respect. And so, you know, and what I was explaining was, you know, everything in a restaurant multiplies. If a napkin costs you 10 cents and you can somehow get away with buying it for 9 cents and somehow get the customers to use 20% fewer of them, then the bottom line at the end of the year, you've saved $11,000. But if you're if it's your passion, if it's something that you love, if it's something that your reputation is staked on, you'll happily spend the extra 40 cents per person to make homemade mozzarella sticks instead of buying the prepackaged, pre-frozen that you drop into the fryer. And I use mozzarella sticks on purpose because it's not fancy highfalutin food. Okay? It's something that anybody could make who wanted to make it with just a little bit of pride, with just a little bit of concern. And then that's what I think. I think the mom and pops, for the most part, obviously every restaurant is different. But when you talk about something that is somebody's livelihood and somebody's reputation as opposed to somebody's only concern is the bottom line, you get a lot more in the end result. You get a lot more out of what they put on a plate.
Yeah, I mean, and right, there's that. I mean, really, it's a perfect example would be not just mozzarella sticks, but if you think about pizza, like in New York in the 60s and 70s, pizza was, I mean, much more individuated. You know, I mean, pizza had personality. Everybody, the guys that did it were Italian-Americans who had their own sauce recipe, you know. And I think it's like meatballs. Everybody says, oh, my meatballs are the best. They all taste the same, but they're a little tiny bit different. And, you know, again, like once it became something that, you know, like the original Ray's chain or licensing names and something, and like all the pizza started tasting the same. And
yep.
Even if it's good, it still changes the dynamic of what it means to be going into that restaurant.
Yeah,
imagine
totally.
What it would be like if every bar you went into was a Houlihan's.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? I mean, bars is where a lot of social life happens. I mean, so that's one of the reasons I live in New York and not, you know, in a nice house somewhere, because, you know, you can get all these wonderful things when you live in a nice house, but every restaurant and bar you go to is some kind of a corporate outpost.
Yeah, and the further you get from New York, I mean, there are certainly parts of the country. Mark goes to Florida, Central Florida once in a while, and there's nothing there but a chain restaurant. And that's really sad for the community. But, hey, Josh, you do great things for the community in writing about all this stuff. You can read Josh Ozersky in Time Magazine. You can pick up his new book, Colonel Sanders and the American Dream, and you can find out about all that stuff at Restaurant Guys Radio and radio.com. Josh, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Josh.
Hey, thanks a lot, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure to have you. And you guys stick with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to us on RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Friends. So I like this book, and I liked it because it was more about the guy, and there's stuff I didn't know about the guy. And he's a hoot, by the way. Did you know that the first – here's some fun facts about Colonel Sanders that I know now reading his book. Did you know that the first suit was black? He used to wear a black suit before mm-hmm. the white suit. Did you know that
– I read the book, so I knew all this. So you need to be talking to them, not
I
to
I am, but you're my foil. Did you know out in – you might have missed this one – that he when he first started with the Colonel Sanders thing – His beard wasn't white.
Yes, so that was great.
So he bleached
it. I got to tell you, that was my favorite fact in the whole book, is that
I need to
look like an old plantation owner. I'm going to dye my beard white because I'm not old enough yet.
You know what else I'm going to do as soon as we get off the air? I'm going to go and look up that spice mix.
Absolutely.
And we are going to make ourselves some chicken.
We are going to make ourselves some fried chicken.
Hey, listen, you can find that. We'll post it when we find the website. We'll post that
under
this show.
Absolutely, 99X.
Restaurant Guys Radio. And what we'd love for you to do is if you do order this stuff and you do make some chicken, we'd love to know how it turned out. So send us an email. Maybe we'll even have you on the show to talk about it. And in the meantime, always listen to us at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. You can download our podcast on iTunes. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. We'll see you next week.